Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The heat is on and farmers are beginning to see the effects as they try to save their crops. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. We'll also be taking a look at the latest assessment of the restoration efforts in the Chesapeake Bay that came this week. But first, we turn to the hot summer weather. For farmers in Maryland, the news is not necessarily good. This week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said that 26% of corn and soybean crops are rated as poor or very poor. The grain prices are also going up with a smaller crop size expected this year. So we first want to turn to some folks who are in the agriculture business. John Aid, he's the Vice President of Domestic Grain for Purdue Agribusiness, as well as Ted Wykall, who is with Green Organic Farm. Welcome to the show. John, I want to turn to you because you kind of set your ear to the ground here when it comes to the farmers and growing grain. What's the situation like? How bad is it so far in terms of particularly corn and soybeans, which are some key ingredients to chicken feed?
Well, I think, part of the challenge that we have this year is just that we had such a great start this spring. We got the crops in record time and, all across the country from, the Dakotas all the way, through the Midwest and even, out up and down the Mid-Atlantic. So, you couldn't have asked to get crops put in a more timely manner. Yeah, so, that was, got everyone excited and ready for a record crop, of which, the initial forecast, had us, at above trend line type yields. And then everything just kind of started slowing down. And so, crops had progressed pretty good. We ended up having, some areas that started to, lack in rainfall, but the heart of the Midwest was still getting some rain. And and as time has moved on, those everywhere has continued to get a little bit drier. So, I think the one of the critical things that is just really difficult to measure. We don't know exactly how the new genetics that they keep talking about that are more drought resistant. This is right now on the map probably has the same kind of conditions as 1988, which was one of our worst droughts. So. Last week was a really tough week. We had 77% of the crops that was silking or pollinating, and typically our average, a five-year average, would be about 30%. So, you had a majority of the crop trying to pollinate in 100 to 105 degree temperatures, of which, there's definitely going to be some damage. Now, that happens over a couple of week periods, so... trying to measure exactly the full effect of that's going to be tough. So this is going to be one of those that, you drive down the road, you'll see one good field and you'll see another field that looks disastrous. So it's going to be really difficult to put a yield on this.
Because I understand I guess for a state, for Maryland, they've said about something like 49% in Maryland is less than good quality in terms of the corn. But it's also said that about 40% of the corn had been silked, at least as of last Tuesday. And my understanding is that, during this pollination period particularly, if this stuff gets so hot, it'll just simply cook the pollen. It just will not be.
Exactly. Yeah.
Are we looking at a disastrous time for farmers then coming in, or is there time for us to get out of this thing yet?
Well, we definitely have had, the temperatures ease off, and we've been a little bit more fortunate out here on the shore than some other areas. We've had, over the past 10 days, some rains as much as 3 inches in some areas up around Seaford. But most areas, were a half inch to an inch, maybe an inch and a half. So, we did get some relief in there, and we did get some moisture. But when you drive around, you can see a lot of firing stalks in some of that. So clearly we're going to have damage. We were off like everyone else. We were off to a great start. We could have had a real bin buster, but we're down below average now for sure. We have our crops have been pretty widely spread out in their planting, so That'll kind of soften the blow a little bit. But we need to keep getting rain out here because our soils are a little bit lighter and you got to keep feeding it with rain every week.
I want to turn to Ted Weichel. He's with Green Organic Farm, and you're out there in the heat, as it were. Now, also, as I understand it, by the way, that I think you do have some irrigation. I think you have some, so you're not completely dependent upon the rain. What's it like been out there trying to deal with this heat and to keep your crops in good stead?
Well, it's a lot of hard work trying to keep the water going to it. We've got two main production techniques. One is we have our vegetable fields, which we irrigate heavily, and the droughts aren't that bad when we have irrigation to water everything. However, the heat is a problem. Just like corn has a problem pollinating in the heat, tomato pollen dies at 90 or 95 degrees. Other things have problems, and even sometimes as much water as we can pump to it, we'll see a lot of wilting just from the heat alone, not necessarily lack of water. Our pasture-based systems really need the rain right now, so we're seeing a lot of pasture grasses going dormant. The grass is turning brown. So we've still got quite a bit of grass stockpiled for our cattle, but, if something doesn't turn around by, say, the end of August, we'll probably be looking at having to buy in hay, purchase feed for the livestock. It's been really difficult for the chickens as well. They don't like, once it gets about 90 or higher, that's really uncomfortable for them. So we've had to modify a lot of our poultry housing so that we get maximum ventilation.
Well, let me ask you this, because you obviously have irrigation. As a matter of fact, as John mentioned, you'll be able to drive up and down probably pretty soon and see there'll be some brown fields and some that are green. And one of the big differences is that one field is being irrigated and one field is not. But irrigation is not free. It'll drive up the price of or the cost of producing this product. What kind of impact does that have on the cost or the price that you can sell your products as? What kind of add-on is that?
Well, it certainly cuts into the profit margins. We don't necessarily mark up. We don't change our pricing depending on how much irrigation we have to do. We just kind of take the hit. But it's a lot of work. I mean, very frequently in these heat waves, I'm having to set my alarm clock for 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning to get out of bed, make sure that everything's still pumping right, there's no floods, and if the irrigation is getting ready to wind down and be finished, you have to go out and turn it off. So it's difficult because you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you have to go out in the field and then have to get up again at about 5 to get started with the crew. And I really think to give a nod to all the farmers and farm workers out there that are enduring the heat, because it's rather painful. So it's a lot of early mornings. It's getting started as early as possible, really as early as we can see to work, and staying well hydrated, making sure that everybody's taking it fine. I mean, we've definitely already this year, myself included, have had some heat related issues as far as heat exhaustion goes. So I know right about in the middle of that heat wave, it was every time I would bend over to pick something up and stand back up again, I'd get so dizzy, I almost had to sit down. So we've had a lot of that out there, and I'm really grateful that our crew is enduring it so well, and all the other farmers and farm workers out there are keeping at it.
I was going to ask you, by the way, what is it like to work out in the heat? Do you go out during the day, or do you try to do it at other ends? How do you keep cool, as they say?
We don't keep cool. It's just we start at about 6 o'clock in the morning, sometimes a little earlier, and pretty much just work right through it. We usually go from about 6 to 4, and then if it's just myself and I don't have a crew to manage, then I'll kind of try to stay indoors during the heat of the day. But we actually don't even have air conditioning in my house, so it's not much relief there. It's a lot of long days just because the days are so long anyway, and the weeds are growing so fast and the crops are growing so fast, and it's a lot of you know, life is just, you know, all the life forms out there in the field, whether it be bugs or plant or whatever it is, you know, basically we're at the peak of the season right now. So we're just seeing really fast growth, and it just, it means that we have to be constantly vigilant of the conditions in the field. And so that means a lot of long days. So, you know, generally speaking, putting in 12, 14, 15 hour days this time of year. And it's the July and August. It's just what, you know, what I come to expect every July and August, just the way it, just kind of the way it goes.
Sean, you're with Purdue, and obviously you keep track of grain prices. And I was looking around, and I guess in like in 2010, I think the bushel was like $3.83. And the last figure I saw was for this year in May, I guess, was $6.33. May have gone up since then. And same thing with soybeans. They were, what, I think in 2010, about almost $10. Now they're almost $11, a couple of bucks up per bushel. What does this do to grain prices? I mean, do you expect the prices, do you think, to go even further, even higher? I mean, at this point, depending on what's going on, what do you see there?
Well, you know, we had a crop report out here, you know, this week, and you know, everyone expected U.S. yields to be reduced on both corn and beans, of which they were. They were reduced pretty dramatically to U.S. corn yields, about 164. So, you know, we've actually got corn near record highs. You know, we just touched, you know, on the July contract, just under $8, you know, in the 790 level. You know, but as you look out in into December, you know, corn futures, which is where most of this new crop coming out of the field gets priced, you know, we're in that 750 range, which is, you know, getting up in the you know, in the all-time high areas. So, you know, clearly the market is, in the world market, is, you know, watching and reacting pretty dramatically. You know, we've got a, you know, we were in a process of, with the amount of corn acres coming in, being able to probably build back some inventory in U.S. stocks. But given what we've seen here, these kind of prices are set to see what kind of demand destruction that, you know, we might be able to come up with. And you know, because whether you're, you know, making ethanol or whether you're making, you know, feed or feeding livestock, you know, these, you know, these numbers get, you know, very pricey in the cost of the feed. So, and you got the same thing going on in soybeans. You know, soybeans a pretty tight balance sheet. We just came out of South America. That crop, you know, a little bit like corn, U.S. corn, got planted, you know, pretty timely, but, you know, it continued to be dry down that area. So, you know, we've got beans, you know, right now trading, you know, up in the mid-15s for harvest. It's over $16 a bushel in the nearby. So, yeah, that is, you know, very high priced, and you know, and that, yeah, as we watch every day, I think there's a little more people are a little more comfortable in the bean market. Well, $16 isn't necessarily a comfortable price, but a little more comfortable that the, if we get additional rains, that we can still have a pretty good bean crop, but yet we still have very tight ending stocks in beans. So, yeah, when these markets get this volatile, it starts to get pretty crazy.
Let me ask you this: I mean, you're obviously in charge of the grain, but you know, your company Purdue is also known for raising chickens, and so the question becomes: then, what does this do in terms of, particularly the chicken farmers, a lot of folks that you contract with? This drives their cost up, and what is this doing in terms of people being able to contain those costs and sell their chickens? And I understand that the chicken market is not always that great, and the demand has not been necessarily all that great for them. So, explain some of the market forces there for me.
Well, I think, you know, as I say, I'm on the grain side, so I get a little dangerous to start talking about chicken. But the one part of that is, you know, we actually are buying, that is, Purdue's buying the ingredients, making the feed, and putting the feed on the, you know, in the integrated, you know, industry, you know, we're the ones that are putting that, you know, into the chicken. So But you know, as mentioned, you know, this heat is obviously the challenge on the producer side is just to try to keep, you know, birds alive in this type of, you know, type of condition. So, I mean, I think you know, as Ted mentioned, I mean, it's, yeah, it's extremely hot out there, you know, trying to keep, you know, animals alive, you know, even in whether it's here or in the Midwest, you know, typically, you know, the feed efficiencies go down because it gets hot and animals don't eat, and you know, and so you start to reduce some of that, you know, some of that usage just by default a little bit. So, yeah, and that's, you know, that's just, you know, it's one of those things that in the last several years has become a, you know, part of the, you know, discussion is, you know, where food prices, you know, ultimately end up, you know, having to bear, you know, some of these costs at some point, you know, when supplies do get tight enough. And, you know, we were just coming out of a, you know, a pretty radical year in the past year with price volatility. And since 2008, you know, we've just, the volatility in price action, you know, makes it really difficult to manage through that.
I want to also now, you know, as we said a moment ago, that there's a third year in a row, we are looking, obviously, at Maryland being hit with drought-like conditions. And one of the questions that arose for me is whether or not we're looking at the wave of the future. I mean, there's a new study that's about to be published in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society, and it found that global warming made a severe heat wave that hit Texas, for instance, last year, is about 20 times as likely as it had been in, say, 1960. I want to turn to Mike Tidwell. He's with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. He's on the phone with us. And Mike, give us some sense about, as we look at these variations, particularly the heat wave, and we've heard also now obviously heard how it impacts agriculture. What are we looking at in terms of how this might change the way we may have to farm?
Well, Don, thanks for having me on your show. You know, all Marylanders, including farmers, really have been, you know, dramatically feeling the impact of this hot weather and all the storms that we've had. You know, as you just heard, you know, hardworking farmhands getting heat exhaustion, tomatoes wilting, corn not pollinating. These are real problems that ultimately hurt consumers and hurt farming families. You know, we've always had droughts in the past. We've always had heat waves. We've always had big storms. But what we're finding in the last few years is that those extreme droughts and extreme storms are just coming more frequently. They're just happening more often. And when they happen, they tend to be a little bit more severe, a little bit bigger, a little bit longer. And climate scientists, you know, under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration, at the United Nations, across the world, all agree that the warming of the planet through the use of fossil fuels, oil, coal, and natural gas, is what's driving the temperature up. And one of the consequences of driving the temperature of the planet up is that places like the Eastern Shore of Maryland can expect, you know, longer heat waves and bigger droughts. And then when the storms come, they'll be more intense. And, you know, there are a number of folks who have trouble wrapping their minds around that, who maybe hear skepticism coming from other quarters saying, no, it's not really happening, or we don't know that our use of fossil fuel and carbon dioxide is driving it. But here's something I think everybody on the Eastern Shore should keep in mind, and not many folks know this, but in December 2006, Allstate Insurance Company, which last time I checked wasn't a Democratic corporation or a Republican corporation. This is a private company with its own capital at risk. Allstate Insurance Company announced that it would stop offering new homeowners insurance policies to anybody on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Why did they do that? They said because Atlantic storms are getting bigger, there's more impacts of extreme weather on the eastern shores of the United States, and that sea level is rising. So here's an insurance company that gave us a warning in 2006, and I think we're starting to see those impacts.
Let me ask you this, returning to agriculture, do you see us, if this is clearly long-term, and we certainly seem to be heading into at least some pretty tough weather here, do you think that there is some ability to change the way we farm that will get us around at least the short term? Because, I mean, even if you're trying to change the rise of the heat in the on the globe, that's going to take a while. We're stuck with this. And I'm just wondering, are farming patterns going to change in terms of what we plant? I mean, what's your sense about that?
Well, two major changes are going to have to come to farming if Maryland farmers are going to survive. One, you're going to see more irrigation, more efficient forms of irrigation, more turning to drip irrigation. There's just going to be less water and more use for water, more need for water. So I think that, you know, the U.S. Farm Bureau has documented over and over again that there are great improvements that could be made in irrigation efficiency. I think you're just going to see an amazing technology improving that. And we're not going to have a choice because, as you said, the planet is going to continue to warm. We have some momentum built into warming because of our use of fossil fuels. But I would disagree on the point that we're just stuck with, you know, uncontrollable warming. The same scientists that have been warning us and insurance companies that have been warning us that global warming is real and it's driven by our use of oil, coal, and natural gas are also saying that if we switch to alternatives to fossil fuels quickly in the next 10 to 20 years, that we can stave off the worst impacts of global warming, which is why I and many Marylanders share a vision, a very realistic vision, that farmers on the eastern shore can start harvesting more than just grains and tomatoes, and soon we'll start harvesting wind. You know, a vision where there are a string of wind farms all along the eastern shore down to the mouth of the bay, and ultimately offshore wind farms that can generate the electricity that we need for farming, for our cities, without contributing to global warming, so we can reach a point where we ultimately phase out fossil fuels, have a zero carbon economy, and we can stabilize our climate.
I want to turn back to John Aid for a moment with Purdue, because one of the things that struck me particularly as I was been watching some of this, and a suggestion that perhaps we're looking at the future, that this is not just a few years and we're going to get a lot of rain back. I would think if I were a farmer, I would be really concerned that I might be looking at the way I farm, or if I even continue to farm, if we're looking at this kind of continuing kind of great variations in terms of weather, particularly with this kind of drought. What do you think? I mean, does it?
Well, I think, the one thing that, you know, that does happen is that, you know, there's no question that in the seed side of the industry, there's a lot of efforts being put on with more drought-resistant type varieties. Over the last several years, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, and there's a lot of time and energy and money being put into that from the research standpoint. So, I mean, I think, the technology side of that. Now, obviously, you still have to have water to grow a crop, there's definitely a lot of emphasis on that. So I think, you know, from the plant side, that, you know, there's a real strong focus on. But, you know, you're seeing across, Delmarva's obviously been continued to increase the amount of irrigated crops that we have. But you're seeing that move across the country. You see more irrigated ground in the Midwest in areas that have very good soils, heavy soils, but given these type of prices, it creates a new era for people to actually, you know, there's been some very good margins over the last couple of years, so producers are putting that back into guaranteeing that they can supply a big crop.
I want to now turn to the Chesapeake Bay and the efforts to restore the Chesapeake Bay. This week, the six states and the District of Columbia within the Chesapeake Bay watershed met in Virginia, and along with the Environmental Protection Agency and an assessment by environmental groups, that assessment has emerged and indicates that at least they're looking at the right track to clean up the bay. It's essentially a review of the goals that were outlined and sort of a pollution diet that's aimed at cutting the flow of urban and farm runoff, as well as other water fouled by the sewage and storm flowing into the bay. And we want to bring in one of those groups. That is with Alan Girard. He's with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. He's been in Salisbury. And the Bay also, the foundation, authored the co-authored the assessment with the Choose Clean Water. So I guess one of the things I want to ask you, Alan, is are we on the right direction? And how bright of an assessment should we make of this, as the, all the states seem to get together and everybody seemed to say, yeah, I think we're actually going to make our goals down the road.
Thanks for having me, Don. Yeah, the history of the Bay restoration effort, you know, a lot of folks have been hearing about the Bay cleanup over the last several decades. And, you know, the facts are we have made progress. You know, in Maryland, you know, since 1985, the Bay restoration effort has produced nearly half of the progress that we need in order to get the Bay off the federal dirty waters list. So, you know, that's improvement. We've actually seen significant improvements in the agriculture sector. We've seen significant improvements in the centralized wastewater treatment sector. You know, these are our wastewater treatment plants, and that's significant. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the effort that's been applied, you know, prior to 2008 had been voluntary measures. And, you know, what about that extra 50% to finally, you know, get us over the goal line? You know, there was an agreement among the Bay states and D.C. and the Environmental Protection Agency to get the Bay out of the federal dirty waters list by 2010. In 2008, they realized they weren't going to get there. And so there was a commitment to say, OK, you know, let's roll up our sleeves and finally get the job done. So the charge now is to, by 2025, have all of the practices in place we need to get the Bay off that dirty waters list. And, you know, unlike the previous commitments and the voluntary approach, what we have now are these milestones, these two-year increments by which we monitor and measure progress. And so what the Executive Council reported on Monday was the progress on the first increment. Towards that 2025 commitment. 2009, 2011, how'd we do? And Chesapeake Bay Foundation partnered with the Choose Clean Water Coalition to do an analysis to evaluate progress on agriculture, urban and suburban stormwater runoff, wastewater treatment. And we found out of eight of the indicators that we looked at under those three sectors, five of them did meet the goal to get us to at least to 2017. And that's significant progress. It's important to know that this is a journey. We do need to, you know, take the long view and be willing to adapt and adjust and respond to different circumstances so that we can continue to get the job done.
Now, as a matter of fact, I mean, one of the things, I guess one of the areas where I guess they said we've come close is the septic systems and nitrification. And we now have a brouhaha of sorts going on in Annapolis, in which they're supposed to, they want to impose some new regulations for new septic systems to be more efficient in terms of keeping nitrogen out. That sounds like it's going to be another battle coming up, and it did not pass. There was a proposal, but was not introduced again in the state legislature. So you got some legislative opposition to that. I know I saw some of that actually coming out of the Eastern Shore. What about that?
Well, you know, the septic systems are, you know, interesting because while we've seen improvement in the centralized wastewater treatment, we've seen improvement in agriculture, septic systems are not making the gains that we need to. And, you know, the facts are that this is 100-year-old antiquated technology. And it's technology that does not treat nitrogen pollution. This is one of the chief pollutants in the Bay. It causes dead zones, fish kills, low crab harvest. It's a problem that needs to get addressed. You know, in current law, if there is new construction that would require a septic system to treat the waste from that new residential development located in what's known as the critical area, you would be required to use best available technology. The most current technology that really addresses that 100-year-old problem of using the old technology. The proposal now is to ensure that every newly constructed septic system has that new technology in place. And that's just common sense. you know, we still have 80% of Maryland that, you know, doesn't have that requirement. So we need to get that done. You know, the septic systems that, you know, the traditional systems currently produce four times the pollution that the new technology can address. And so, you know, in order to continue the progress that we're making, we really do need to make sure that we're using the best technology that's out there.
We've been speaking with a number of people. There was Alan Gerard. He's with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Also earlier, Mike Tidwell. He's with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, talking about global warming. And also from Purdue, John Aid. He's the Vice President of Domestic Grain for Purdue Agribusiness, as well as Ted Wykall, who is with the Green Branch Farm. That's the Green Branch Farm. And we want to appreciate all of you taking the time with us this morning. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.